And to sort of put this, to give you sort of some sort of perspective, let me remind you a little bit about the Monge-Ampère equation. So if you look at the Monge-Ampère equation, right-hand side, f, it could depend on x or u, du, it doesn't really matter. Then if we look, say, at the zero boundary condition, Dirichlet condition, there's an estimate of Pogorelov around 1970, I think, give or take a year. And it's a second derivative bound. So it says that second derivatives are bounded by some constant over minus u at x for all x in omega. Okay, so so the picture is like this. U zero on the boundary, it's negative inside. So minus u is zero on the boundary and positive inside. And the estimate looks like this. The second derivatives on the interior are controlled in this way. And this constant depends on say the L infinity norm of u, maybe on the gradient, and on the domain, I guess, the diameter or something, and on G or F. I called it F here. F, and its first and second derivatives, and that estimate is a really central estimate in the theory of Monge-Ampère equations. It gets used almost all the time. It's one of the central things in Caffarelli's regularity theory. In many problems that lead to a Monge-Ampère equation, very often you end up getting some sort of generalized solution, and then you argue, depending on the problem, you argue that the solution in fact is strictly convex, so the tangent plane at any point of the graph, any point inside, it touches only at that point, so you can lift a little bit, and so on this subdomain you have a solution of this sort of equation with maybe not u equals zero, but u equal to an affine function, which is just as good. And so you apply the estimate on things like on these subdomains to get regularity. So it's a really, this estimate's a really key estimate in the whole theory of Monge-Ampère equations. The estimate I want to talk about today is an analog of that for more general equations. So first of all, we've got a bunch of structure conditions here, which you needn't worry too much about, except that so F is a symmetric function, positive on a cone, zero on the boundary. So for in the Monge-Ampère case, it's the positive cone. It's a concave function. It's increasing in each variable. So this means it's you've got an elliptic problem as long as the solution has principal curvatures belonging to gamma at each point. And then you've got a couple of technical conditions which they get used in the proof, but you needn't worry too much about them. They're just some structure conditions you need to make the proof go. This condition here is not used for the curvature bound at all. That's a condition that has to do with a gradient bound, which I'm not going to talk about, but I like to get all the structure conditions out of the way at the beginning. I don't have to worry about them. So you've got some conditions. And the equation we're looking at the principal curvatures of the graph are given by some function f like this, and that's prescribed to be some function x, u, some positive function. That's the equation. So the typical examples are this one, which we've already seen, the k curvature, and the ratio of these things. They're typical examples, and there are many others you can build from these. And we want to look at the Dirichlet problem with zero on the boundary, or we could take an affine function, doesn't really matter. Okay, and we're always interested in solutions which are admissible in the sense that at each point the principal curvatures of the graph belong to this cone. Okay, so that's the problem. So what's known about this problem? Well, what's known is the first result, apart from special cases, so I want to exclude things like the mean curvature and the Gauss curvature equation, which are sort of were treated much earlier, but each one using sort of specialized techniques. So what's known in general? Well, the first result is something by Caffarelli, Nirenberg, and Sprach in 1988. If the domain is uniformly convex and there is an admissible subsolution with the same boundary value, zero, then you can solve the problem. Then there is an admissible solution and it's smooth up to the boundary. So that's the first result in this direction. Then after that there was a lot of work on these two special cases, the K curvature and the ratios, by Ivochkina and Trudinger and Lin. So some papers by Ivochkina, some by Trudinger, some by Trudinger and Lin, some by all three. It's about half a dozen papers. And basically what they showed is that for these two classes of equations, you can come up with geometrically natural conditions to solve the Dirichlet problem. And if you know about the mean curvature equation, they're sort of analogous to that. So I won't say much more about that, but geometrically natural. And you get solutions which are smooth up to the boundary. Okay, a couple of years after that, around 1990, Trudinger looked at general equations satisfying basically the same conditions that I had up on the first slide, and he proved you could solve those problems provided there was a strict viscosity subsolution of the problem. Now, his solutions were not classical solutions, they were viscosity solutions, they were only Lipschitz. And so what we have is sort of classical solutions under very strong assumptions, classical solutions under reasonable geometric assumptions, but quite a lot of regularity on the boundary. You need C4 boundary data here. And then we have under very weak or reasonably weak conditions, you have Lipschitz solutions. And there's nothing in between, or there was nothing in between for such general equations. And the obstacle really was an interior second derivative bound or a curvature bound. And this next theorem is joint work with Sheng and Wang. It's a will appear in the Duke Journal sometime this year or maybe next year, I don't know, basically answers this question. It provides an interior curvature bound, or if you like, the great under, I won't go through all the assumptions, but well, the gradient is bounded, so if you like, you could think of this as being the same as a bound for the second derivatives. And again, it depends on a whole bunch of structure constants and on the right-hand side and so on. And you get not minus u at the bottom, you get some power, which doesn't matter for applications. Okay, and this is a genuine interior curvature bound, because on any compact subset, minus u is bounded from below, and you can use, if that's a solution, you can use large hemispheres as comparison functions to prove this statement. So that's the theorem. Okay, so now I want to go through the proof of this, or at least the main points. Okay, so as usual, you need to, if you want to bound the second fundamental form, you need an equation for the second fundamental form. This is what it looks like. So you get a term which comes when you differentiate. So second fundamental form is basically like second derivatives mixed in with the gradient. So basically, you have to differentiate the equation twice, and that gives you a term like this, which comes from taking, well, you get the term which you use the chain rule, you differentiate twice, you get second derivatives of the second fundamental form, then you get a quadratic term in first derivatives, and then you get the stuff from differentiating the right-hand side, and then you get these other terms in the middle here, which come from commuting covariant derivatives. So here I'm working on the graph, and I'm using an orthonormal frame, a local orthonormal frame, and these are covariant derivatives, so they don't commute, so you get these extra terms. Okay, well, all the terms here, this term here is a good term, it's positive. This one is not so good, it's negative, and you have to somehow control that. Well, if you look at the equation for the components of the normal to the graph, you get a term which looks very much like that, at least the first part of it. So the idea is that you will use this equation to control that term. Okay, so you go about this in the fairly standard sort of way. You look at a function W. You want to bound the curvature, so you put in the second fundamental form, and you look at the second fundamental form in all possible tangent directions. You put in some function depending on the normal, on the n plus first component, which is more or less like the gradient. And then you put in a cutoff function, eta, because you want to make it a local estimate. Okay? So, and then you look at where this, so this function is zero on the boundary. You look at where it has a maximum. Well, it'll have a maximum at some point x0, and in a tangential direction, psi 0, which we can take to be the E1 direction, right? And the cutoff function is going to be eta equals minus u. So it's positive inside, 0 on the boundary. And then we can make some assumptions about, we can rotate the frame so it's diagonal at the point we're looking at. Then there's this other condition. What this does is makes the Christoffel symbols vanish at the point you're working at. So covariant derivatives look more like ordinary derivatives. So instead of looking at the function W tilde, you really look at this, where I forgot to write it. This is a vector field, has components like this in the particular frame I've chosen, right? Then you find, because you've chosen the frame, so it's diagonal, the second fundamental form is diagonal, and because of this condition here, you find that this function Z, or Z, I don't know, is it Z or Z in Canada? This satisfies the same equation at that point as the components of the second fundamental form. Remember, this is a scalar. Second fundamental form is a tensor, so you can't just take a component of it. There are extra terms which come from the curvature. Okay, but for the purposes of this computation, if you choose this frame carefully, you can do that. So you get, at the maximum point, this function W has zero derivative. And this is an important equation. What it allows you to do is, for example, you can take this term and solve for that in terms of these two. Or you can take this term and solve for that in terms of these two. Right? So that's going to be used several times. So that's an important equation. And then when you take the second derivatives at the maximum point, it's non-positive, and you do a computation, this is what you get. So when you use the equations for the second fundamental form and for the normal and plug it all in, what you end up with is this stuff. And if you look at this for a while, you see you've got some good terms and some bad terms. The good terms are this one and this one, and this term is not good, has the wrong sign, and this term has the wrong sign as well. And then you've got this term, which I'll come to in a minute. And then you've got a whole bunch of stuff here. And the idea is, eventually you want to choose phi to get rid of these terms. And you're left with enough good stuff to get an estimate out. So let's look at these terms. So the first term is this one. And this is where you really use the boundary condition. Gauss's formula says that the position vector is basically, you take two derivatives of that, that's basically the second fundamental form. So if you plug in, U is the n plus first component of the position vector. So if you use this, plug it in, you get here Fij, Hij, and by the structure conditions, that's just something that's bounded. If you think of F, say, being homogeneous of degree 1, then this just gives you F back, which is the right-hand side, which is a bounded thing. So you get something that's reasonable there. If you don't choose the cutoff function in this way, then typically you get something which depends on the trace. And for these equations, the trace is usually something that's not under control. And if you try to use an arbitrary cutoff function, this term gives you great problems. And in fact, we know from what I said in the first lecture, for the K Hessian equations, you have non-smooth solutions, even with a smooth positive right-hand side. The same is true for K curvature, at least for K bigger than or equal to 3. So you know that you can't take an arbitrary cutoff function. You need to somehow use the boundary condition in general, and this is where the boundary condition comes in. It's used for a special choice of cutoff function. Okay, so that takes care of that term. Now, the other terms. Okay, well, now we break it up into two cases. So we order the eigenvalues in this way, and remember, Hij is diagonal, and that means that the Fij is also diagonal. And if we denote the eigenvalues by F1 up to Fn, then the inequality goes the other way for these things, by concavity. It's a simple exercise by concavity. So we choose, well, we look at two cases. First of all, we look at the case where the minimum eigenvalue is negative and it's bounded by from below, or from above, bounded away from zero by some controlled multiple of the maximum eigenvalue, or the maximum principal curvature. In that case, what we do is we just throw away this term that comes here. And this term, we use it, remember I said we can use the once differentiated equation to solve for certain terms in others. We use that to solve, to replace this by something involving grad eta over eta and some other stuff. So what that stuff looks like. You basically do this, and you get some more eta terms, and you get some more terms which look like the stuff we had here. So when you plug that in to the inequality you've got, you get something that looks like this. Gradient of eta is bounded, so that just goes into the constant. You get a trace, that's the sum of the Fi's, and you get all this stuff here. And the idea now is to choose this phi so that you get something non. So this stuff here is something positive you can use. Okay, well, you do that. Well, for a reason which is maybe not obvious now, but will be in a little while, you've got this 1 plus gamma here. So you write 1 plus gamma as 1 plus epsilon times 1 plus e to the minus 1, okay? You can do that, because gamma is still just free, and epsilon and betas, they're still to be fixed. And then you play with what you've got there, and you cook up a function phi, which works. It turns out that this function works, and if you plug it in, you see that all those terms, you get something positive out of it with that choice of phi. Okay, so when you plug that in, what you've got left here, you've got a little bit left over here. You've got a coefficient half a squared outside, and a is positive lower bound for the component of the normal. So what you've got left with is, well, if you estimate this, just keep the n terms, you get fn, and that's bigger than times the trace, because the fn's the inequalities go this way. And then we're in case one, so lambda n squared is bounded from below by theta squared lambda 1 squared. So you throw all that together, and what you're left with is this. And if you look at this, you see that gives you the bound, right? If you sort of put in an eta squared there and put an eta squared on the bottom, you see that the trace is bounded from below by a positive constant. That's one of the structure conditions. And you see this term here is going to dominate that and everything else.
Did you sort that?
No, theta is still free. So at the moment what I've got is this sort of bound with beta and theta still to be fixed. Okay, so that's the easy case. It's a lot like the uniformly elliptic case, right? Case two is when the minimum curvature is bounded from below by minus theta times the maximum eigenvalue. And that means that since this is the minimum, that means all of them are bounded from below by the same thing. Now, what we do now is we look at these indices from 1 to n, and we break it up into two sets. A set where the j is where fj is less than 4 times f1, and the leftover stuff where fj is bigger than 4 times f1. And now we look, if j is in the first set, in I, we solve for first derivatives of the curvature using that inequality in this way, and we estimate it. So we get some more of these sorts of terms and some gradient of eta terms. And for j in capital J, we solve for the eta things. And we pick up more of this sort of stuff, and we pick up some gradient of second fundamental form here. And this doesn't look like it's going to work. So when you sum over all j's, what you get is something that looks like this. And it's sort of surprising that this works, because you'd expect you'd pick up too much of this stuff in the middle here. But actually you don't. What you pick up is exactly what you had before. That was the reason I wrote that before. I wrote 1 plus gamma is 1 plus epsilon. So it has exactly the same form as before. So when you put it into the equation, use exactly the same function, that term disappears, you're left with this, and you're left with instead of having sum over all j's here, it's just sum over capital J, and you've got a little bit extra here. And what you've gained by this, you see, is instead of having the whole trace here, you've just got the minimum eigenvalue of F1. Right? Rather than having the whole trace. So it's sort of a trade-off between either getting rid of all of the stuff here or getting rid of all of the stuff that you had before down here. Neither of those works. It's sort of an intermediate trick, and the price you pay is not too high, it turns out. Okay? So the question is now, well, all this stuff up here is okay. What the stuff that's left here, if you can show that is non-negative, you're finished. Okay, and to show that is non-negative, you have to understand what this looks like. Okay, well, what it looks like is this. So this is something that was worked out by Ben Andrews and Klaus Gerhardt independently. And the proof is a little bit messy. I think there's probably... In fact, I don't know how Andrews proved it. He just stated the result. Klaus Gerhardt's proof goes on for a couple of pages and considers lots and lots of cases. So possibly there is a simpler proof. But anyway, so this part we don't need. We just throw that away by concavity of F. And this part is what's interesting. So the case that we're in, if you use this, you get a bound like this. So each of the terms here is negative. You keep the terms where you've got I equal to 1, and you keep the terms where you've got J equal to 1. So that gives you the 2 there. And then lambda 1 is H1, 1. So you get that, you get the minus sign, and that's what you get. So to show that the bottom stuff there is non-negative, you have to show that this is bigger than or equal to this stuff here for J in capital J. And if you rearrange this a little bit, clean it up, what you have to show is this for J in capital J. And at this stage, if you set delta equal to this constant over beta, you've still got some freedom. You're allowed to choose delta small, and the theta that came into those conditions, case 1, case 2, that's still free to be chosen. Okay, so remember the case J in capital J means that Fj is bigger than 4F1. So certainly if delta is small, this term will dominate that one, and if this is negative, things are fine. So if lambda J is positive, it's okay. On the other hand, if lambda J is negative, then we know in absolute value it's small compared to lambda 1. In fact, we're free to choose this theta still. So you are free to choose it. So it turns out appropriate choices are delta equal to 1/4, theta equal to 1/5. And that gives you this here. And once you've done that, what you're left with is this. And from that you get the bound. Okay, so that's the proof of the curvature bound. And it's quite interesting. Up till now, apart from a few exceptions, most people have been quite happy to just throw away this concavity term. And it turns out to be really crucial to making the whole proof work. If you throw it away, you've thrown away too much. You have to use that. And this has been useful for other sorts of problems too. If you handle this concavity term in a similar way, you can improve various results for Hessian equations on Riemannian manifolds. So I talked about that in Banff last week. You can improve some work of Bayard on the scalar curvature equation in Minkowski space. So he was able to get results in 3 and 4 dimensions. Using this idea, you get a much simpler proof in all dimensions. So I think the technique is very useful. And I think it will turn out to be useful more generally. Now, once people see how you're supposed to handle the concavity term. So now, some applications of this. Well, the first application is to the Dirichlet problem. So this theorem here is basically Schrödinger's theorem from 1990 if you cross out C2. He proved the existence of Lipschitz solutions. With this new estimate, you get interior regularity. And to do this, you have to solve some approximating problems so you can apply the estimate to smooth solutions and so on. It's a standard sort of procedure. And so you get classical regularity in the interior. And this theorem and the estimate have some, there are various extensions of it which I won't go into, but in particular in the case where the cone is the positive cone, then you can allow C11 boundary data, not just zero boundary condition or affine boundary condition. So that's the most immediate application. A second application is to the plateau problem. So the plateau problem, what we're looking at is, so we've got some curves in space like this, and we want to find a hypersurface, maybe of constant Gauss curvature, constant some other curvature, which has this these curves as its boundary. So I don't know how I'm going to draw this, maybe. Maybe if I just stick to two. Okay, something like this. You want to find a surface that spans that with, and it has, say, constant Gauss curvature or constant some other curvature. And so what's known about that? Well, if you look at, say, the Gauss curvature case, then well, the Dirichlet problem for the Gauss curvature equation is really a special case, and there's a whole lot of work on that by a bunch of people. If you look at... So after that, people decided, well, why should you solve Monge-Ampère equations only on convex domains? So the first step in this direction was work by Hoffman, Rosenberg, and Sprach, and they were interested in getting... surfaces of constant Gauss curvature over, which were graphs over annular domains, so you have to solve the Dirichlet problem on an annular domain. And a little bit later, Guan and Sprach looked at solving the Dirichlet problem on subdomains of the sphere. So you've got some subdomain of the sphere, and the surface was some sort of, was a sort of a radial graph over that subdomain, and they got, under some assumptions, they got surfaces of constant Gauss curvature or prescribed Gauss curvature. And I guess in here, in between, I forgot to mention, there's work of Guan around 1998, maybe. He solved the Dirichlet problem on arbitrary smooth domains in Rn. Okay, but all this stuff was always a Dirichlet problem. So you always, in one way or another, you're in the graphical setting. So you're in a graph over a sphere or over something in Rn. But eventually, this problem was solved independently by Guan and Sprach and Schrödinger and Wang. So the papers appeared last year. And they solved this problem, this plateau problem, without assuming that the surfaces are graphs over something. So that was for the Gauss curvature. Okay, and in the meantime, in 98, Ivochkina and Tomi looked at this sort of curvature function, where it's the ratio of the Gauss curvature to a lower one, and they also solved the Platov problem, but in again in a graphical setting, so it's still a Dirichlet problem. So there weren't graphs necessarily over spheres or over the plane, but essentially there were graphs over something. So you reduce to a Dirichlet problem again. So so using this this new curvature bound and the sort of techniques developed by Trudinger and Wang and Guan and Sprach, you can solve the Platov problem now for more general curvatures. And here's a typical theorem. For this curvature function, you can solve the Platov problem, provided there is a locally uniformly convex hypersurface M0, which is, sort of acts as a super solution, a subsolution to the problem at each point. And the proof of that I'll try and say a few words about the proof of that. Maybe the blackboard would be good for that. So the first point, so you're looking at, so let me draw something very schematic here. You're looking at locally uniformly convex hypersurfaces. So these can be embedded, they can intersect, right? But so schematically it looks something like this. And with, so that's N, and the boundary is here and here. Okay. Now, the first point is that if you have a nice boundary and the surface behaves nicely on the boundary in the sense that the principal curvatures are on the boundary of the surface are bounded between two positive constants, then locally this is a graph in a controlled sort of a way. So if you pick a point and then there's some fixed number r such that this neighborhood is a graph, not necessarily over the tangent plane, but over some plane. Because you may have situations like this, and obviously it's not over that plane, but there is some plane over which it is a graph in a controlled way. You have to be a little bit careful. If I choose this point, then clearly it's there's sort of two pieces. So you have to be a little bit careful about how you phrase this, and it's each piece is a graph over some plane. Okay? And once you've got that, then you can look in here, you can write it as a graph. Let me draw a bigger picture. So if you look on a small ball, if you look, this is the surface, say, M0 now, the one that acts as a subsolution. In here you've got this satisfies this equation. So you can solve with the same boundary values, you can solve F of lambda is equal to k, right, by the Perron method. So, okay, so you have a subsolution, a viscosity subsolution. In this case, it's, In this case, if I assume initially it's C2, then it's actually C2 subsolution, but in general, all you need is a viscosity subsolution, a Lipschitz viscosity subsolution, and then you get a solution with the same boundary values on a small ball, and it's a Lipschitz solution. So here I should say that U is also Lipschitz. Okay, and once you can do that, you can use this to define liftings. So you sort of solve on these balls, you solve here, you solve here, and you keep doing this, and you get a family of sort of liftings of the original sub-solution surface. And then you use a compactness theorem, you get a limit, and that limit is a generalized solution of the plateau problem with constant curvature. And once you've got that, then you can start to study its regularity. The regularity, there are two parts to this. The first part, the interior regularity, well, again, it's like the Monge-Ampère regularity. At each point in the interior, you try to show that it's strictly convex. So if it touches only at that point, at least locally, you can translate a little bit and you get a viscosity solution with affine boundary values in a small neighborhood. And then you can apply the estimate, or rather the regularity result that comes from the estimate. So that gives you interior regularity. Once you've done the interior regularity, then you can go to the boundary regularity, and there you have to apply estimates. This is the main reason for restricting to the case where it's Gauss curvature over a lower curvature. You apply these estimates of Ivochkina and Tomy, which are local estimates at the boundary, and you have to apply them to suitable approximations, and then you pick up the boundary regularity as well for the plateau problem. The main reason we restricted to just this special case, Gauss curvature over something else, is that I didn't want to redo the estimates, Ivochkina and Tomy, for general things. But it's clear if you make the right structure conditions, you can do more general equations. Okay, well, I think that's about all I have to say. Thanks.
When you made the interior second derivative bounds, you call it W in the Gaussian function. It was minus U to the beta.
Yes.
Phi exponential nu n plus 1 and something H to the I to the I. What did Pogorelov?
Pogorelov used minus U again, but he didn't need a power. He used, well, in his original work, he used this sort of thing, where you take first and second derivatives in a given direction, which I think that's okay, but it works better if you just take the full gradient here. Because if you take that, it's not clear that you get something at the maximum that's diagonal, but you can diagonalize it by affine transformations rather than just rotations. But you get around that by using this. So it's a similar thing, but the computation's a bit different.
Let's thank John for his attention. So we resume at